to Imperium Cast 13. Today we have the Prudentialist, and we're going to discuss basically geopolitics, international relations, associated current events, etc. But before we get into it, I just wanted to bring up Imperium Press does have a new text coming out very soon in the Studies and Reaction series, so keep an eye out for that. Make sure, if you don't already, follow Imperium Press on Telegram, link in the description. Also, follow me on Telegram. I haven't really gone back to Twitter after the Twitter apocalypse where we all got banned, so I've got to be on Telegram more. And I've gotten used to the platform more. I actually quite like it. I think Telegram is, in many ways, it's better than Twitter. In some ways, it's not as good, but I enjoy that you can kind of have more long posts. It's more conducive to effort posting, if you will. And so anyway, connect with us there as the primary place to kind of get in touch with us if you aren't already. But today we have the Prudentialist on because the Prudentialist is kind of like the international relations expert of this kind of milieu of dissident right content creators, this little scene that we have, you know, between the regular guests and people that come on this program and the programs that we go on and so forth. So I thought I should get him on because obviously a lot of international relations type things are in the news at the moment. The Ukraine situation, obviously, but we just had the Kazakhstan thing like a month ago. And then last year there was, you know, other political, some people would say attempted color revolutions in places like Kyrgyzstan, Belarus, etc. And so there's all these fault lines in this geopolitical contest, this, you know, great power political contest between the Russians and the Americans. And so it's hard to find good analysis on this because obviously there's so many propagandists, there's so many rival theories and commentaries on what the hell's going on. And it's hard to make sense of. I mean, even me myself, you know, it's a lot of takes floating around and it's difficult to make sense of the situation. And, you know, I thought it would be good to get the Prudentialist on because, you know, he came on my channel, you know, December last year. We did a stream on Mearsheimer's The Tragedy of Great Power Politics, which is my favorite work in international relations theory. I know Prudentialist also rates it very highly. And I love John Mearsheimer's analysis in general. I think he's a great American intellectual, one of the last remaining living great American intellectuals. And this is an important subject, I think, for, you know, to maintain like a rigorous and solid analysis of, because international politics isn't purely international. It also has a lot of relevance to domestic politics, obviously, and you can't really disambiguate the two. And I guess we'll get into that later. But first, you know, make sure you follow the Prudentialist on YouTube. I'll post his YouTube link in the description. He has a kind of like a Sunday stream that he does. Often it's international relations related subjects, but he does videos on lots of other subjects as well. Really good resource, particularly for any like political science students out there or whatever that are kind of getting into this field. And we need to, in our scene, really cultivate that, like, in a political science, international relations, economics, sociology, these kinds of, you know, disciplinary specialists, more of the our own forms of these different specialities that we can generate, the more kind of resident learned men in these fields, the better. So yeah, make sure you follow him on either YouTube or Odyssey, and you can follow him on Twitter, Telegram, and so forth. And also he has a Substack. I'll link all this kind of stuff in the description, and you can kind of find him on the website that Charlemagne made that he just mentioned before we started recording, Find My Friends. And it has profiles for me, actually. Imperium Press, I think Keith Woods, Morgoth, a bunch of other guys from the scene, including Prudentialist himself. And you can kind of, you know, it's a one-stop shop to find everyone's links through all their different places where you can find them online. So I'll post all that in the description, but without further ado, I'll throw it to the Prudentialist to kind of give us his take on the Ukraine situation. What's going on? Are the Russians are about to invade? Is it all Western media hype? You know, what's the deal? And also the larger context of, you know, the Russian-American great power conflict and these other states that are kind of caught in the crossfire and the kind of fault line between these two states. And, you know, how do the Chinese fit into this? And, you know, basically, what's your predictions? What's your analysis of the general situation? Because I think the audience, you know, a lot of people out there kind of want clarity on this subject. So yeah, I'll throw it to you.
Sure. And thank you for having me on. I greatly appreciate it. It's always difficult to say like where to start, right? Because it's always the fun question of where do you really want to begin this through line or narrative. And I find most importantly to sort of start after the end of the Cold War, because sort of the United States is beginning to examine what it wants to accomplish as grand strategy, and in particularly what does it want to do in Europe. And so some of the major things that come out of both the national like security apparatuses and the State Department in the late 1990s is the discussion about what to do in Eastern Europe. And one of the bigger concerns, especially, is that now that Germany is officially unified, American documentation and a lot of American reports had said that their biggest concern about Western Europe was to connect or a strong relationship between a unified Germany and a post-Soviet Russia, both for economic interests, but also primarily for strategic ones. You don't want historically some of the largest military powers in the European continent to have a relatively good relationship. And this is especially because after the end of the Cold War, you sort of start seeing a debate happen in the American foreign policy sector. And it kind of came down to like these four main ideas: cooperative security, intervention, and selective engagement, sort of, and then isolationism and American primacy. So these debates raged on, but it really wasn't until after September 11th, 2001, where sort of the American primacy cooperative security framework takes hold. And we have a pretty good definitive through line from about the early aughts to today about just ongoing eastward expansion towards Russia's borders and sort of the Russian irredenta of former Soviet states and territories that were once Russia, which of course puts Russia in a very awkward position in terms of, you know, the primary objective of any state in terms of foreign policy or grand strategy is to protect territorial sovereignty and not to have your enemy more or less at your doorstep. The Americans, at least within, and I should be very careful when I say the Americans, by that I do mean the government, whether you want to call it the gay, the regime, whatever you want to have it as. I mean, I don't associate it with the American people. And so its government moves forward ever increasing eastward and eastward with NATO expansion to where, sort of to draw the line today, you have Poland, Latvia, Estonia, Lithuania, all pretty much on Russia's borders that are now NATO allies or are part of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. And there are now ongoing talks to get Ukraine into it, which is really sort of the flashpoint which has gotten Russia to be so responsive. And to the Russians that I've talked about, the biggest concern about having Ukraine as a NATO member is that typically implies the installation and establishment and running of American troops to act as a strategic tripwire to invoke Article 5. If you attack one, you attack all. But then secondly, it also means the installation of usually short-range ballistic missiles, typically capable of presenting a nuclear payload, to which, of course, the Russians I've spoken to, they said this is just very reminiscent of the Caribbean crisis, or how it's taught in the United States, and probably for you guys, I don't know, it's just taught as the Cuban Missile Crisis during the 1960s. But you had mentioned color revolution, which has sort of been the down and out policy of the United States for some time. Like American foreign policy, I kind of agreed with Paul Gottfried's analysis. He wrote a great book called Anti-Fascism, which has been that anti-fascism post-war has been the de facto policy of the United States, whether you're supporting decolonialization efforts in Africa to weaken European powers like France or Belgium or the UK, or, you know, anti-fascism is just a really great way also to say that, you know, you can be anti-fascist, but that doesn't necessarily mean you're anti-communist either. So some of the worst of the worst can kind of rain hell in various third world countries throughout the Cold War. And in doing so, that stuff changes. And in C.A. Bond wrote Nemesis about how the Ford Foundation played a major role in that and taking CIA responsibilities. The National Endowment for Democracy has done the same since the early 1990s, which we've seen a wave of color revolutions throughout Eastern Europe throughout the 2000s, whether it's the Orange Revolution in Ukraine and 2004, 2007. One in Kyrgyzstan and other parts of Eastern Europe is just sort of this American advance moves further and further eastward, closer towards Russia, which makes it Russia obviously recognize that this is sort of an existential problem. It has forced Russia to not integrate or have rapprochement with the European continent, although it's trying, and we can get into that. But it's also forced its hand into engaging in sort of a very, what I would say, tenuous alliance with the Chinese that's only being further solidified, which everyone from, you know, Dr. Sumantra Mitra, Mearsheimer, and even Pat Buchanan, when he was writing about, you know, Churchill and Hitler and the war of, you know, the Second World War, that was a great tactical mistake about trying to maintain supremacy over a balance of power. And this all also lies in not just for the policy of strategic containment, but there's also the issue over energy policy, which you can kind of see why there's a lot of American involvement in places like Syria, why there's also a lot of issues now with Russia, too, is because there's the issue of natural gas pipelines. For example, in 2009, Ukraine had entered sort of this arbitration and negotiation over transit fees, about how much, you know, money it could collect for having a pipeline from Gazprom run through the country. And it essentially led in this dispute to the shutdown and lack of access to natural gas that would flow into Western Europe, which triggered an energy crisis. And since then, Russia was like, well, we can't deal with overland countries, right, throughout the Balkans or close to or Ukraine, right, to deal with energy. So we're going to start trying to find a way to bypass these guys, which lo and behold is sort of the Nord Stream project. And with the help of former German Chancellor Gerhard Schroeder, who I believe sits on the board for the project still to this day, they've managed to successfully construct it and have the first pipeline built, I think, around 2011, 2012 timeframe. And they've been pushing for a second one to continue the project. Now, since the fall of the Soviet Union, Russia's primary access for, you know, the international marketplace has been primarily through, you know, infrastructure, investment, roads, telecom, but also most importantly, its natural resources, whether it's its wealth in lumber, mining materials and ores and iron, but also natural gas and its vast reserves there, which to this day for the European Union, primarily in Western Europe, Russia is the dominant supplier of natural gas to that, you know, to the region. I think they have about a 45%, you know, share or cap on the market, which is almost 50%, which is half, which plays a major role because the last thing that, you know, the United States is, you know, security apparatus wants in terms of maintaining primacy is this issue about, okay, if Russia can maintain a steady supply of energy and, you know, keep the powerhouse of the European Union, which is arguably Germany still to this day, even though Merkel has recently no longer become, you know, is no longer chancellor, then that spells concerns for, you know, American interests in there, using cooperative security to get their own interests pursued, as well as to ship, you know, American liquid natural gas over on cargo containers to provide energy. And for the longest time, they've managed to successfully either have it sanctioned or the American government used the German Green Party to, like, sort of hold off for environmental concerns. And this is all happening at the same time while when Angela Merkel was in power, she had to outflank the Greens from the left. So she started pursuing this really strong green energy, anti-nuclear energy policy to where now in 2022, there are only 3 active nuclear reactors for energy inside Germany's borders. And on top of the fact that this crisis is happening in Ukraine and the Nord Stream 2 pipeline hasn't been officially signed off, there's no gas flowing through it the last I checked. And there's this widespread energy crisis to which the Americans have been able to ship off, you know, cargo ships of liquid natural gas to help support it and to provide their own influence. But during the Trump administration, right, you've also seen this talk about European defense autonomy, less reliance on Trump, less reliance on the Americans and NATO and pursuing this. So there's, you know, this idea that the Europeans, especially the West, between Germany and France, wanting to pursue their own options outside of the U.S., the Germans being more open to working with the Russians, despite trying to toe the line with NATO and American policy. And now this rapid deployment of troops over the, you know, alleged claim of invasion. Famous foreign policy scholar and, you know, a man who spent decades on the inside, Edward Luttfak, whose books on strategy are essential reading for anyone out there, You know, he's saying that there's not enough military forces in Belarus or just outside of Ukraine to really mount a successful invasion. And you're getting a lot of media reports that are hyping this up. And it's primarily from sort of the State Department and, you know, strategic officials from the United States and NATO. Just earlier this week, actually, there was a really good sort of back and forth with it was just yesterday. An Associated Press reporter just like tore into the State Department's box because, you know, he had said that the Russians had put out a, you know, false flag. You know, they plan to do some sort of false flag operation to justify an invasion of Ukraine. And, you know, Matt Lee with the Associated Press just asked, you know, the State Department spokesman, just like, do we have any evidence for this? You know, you're saying that there's this propaganda video about explosions and fake corpses and crisis actors. But it's just like, listen, man, we got the same thing about, you know, WMDs and all that other stuff. Like, let's have an actual serious conversation. Why can't we look at this and declassify it and see if this is true? Because if not, you know, you're saying things like he said something along the lines of like crisis actors. This is Alex Jones territory you're getting into. Where's the declassified information, to which, you know, puts the Americans in a hot seat, at least with the government. So to say that it's like easy to explain, I think I've kind of ranted on a little bit to sort of open up discussion. Is just that you have an energy issue, an American grand strategy issue of liberal hegemony. G. John Eikenberry has said since the end of the Second World War, that's sort of been the American foreign policy, is this idea of promoting liberal hegemony across the world. And it kind of gets exacerbated, I think, after the Soviet Union falls, because you have like democratic peace theory, you have jihad versus McWorld, you have that infamous Thomas Friedman article, I think right before we started bombing Bosnia in the 90s, where it was just like, no two countries that have a McDonald's in them have ever gone to war. And lo and behold, we start doing that days after. So you have energy, American concerns over European independence from, you know, the US influence. You have Russia viewing these things as an existential threat and trying to maintain the premise by building up troops and forces in a conflict that, if it were to occur, I don't think that the U.S. or at least its NATO allies would manage to do well, or at least they would be pushed back before mounting a strategic defense, while at the same time, underneath just this blanket organization that is like NATO or the Collective Security Treaty Organization, which is sort of Russia's equivalent nowadays, you also have a lot of moves being made in sort of a bilateral direction. So like, for instance, Turkey wants to produce, you know, military drone equipment in collaboration with the Ukrainians. Macron is wishing to meet with President Putin and Vladimir Zelensky of Ukraine to sort of mediate things. Meanwhile, Boris Johnson had recently announced talks to have a trilateral Ukraine, Poland, and UK sort of defense pact. So there's a million things happening at once. And if we want to break them down individually, then by all means, we can.
Yeah, it seems like the American security interests are kind of, I mean, this is something that obviously has been pursued in earnest since the end of the Cold War, especially, you know, in a with the sort of universalist impulse that you get with liberal democracy that basically has to establish hegemony everywhere in order to feel secure at all. But this impulse kind of seems to run counter to the security interests of the Americans and of NATO more generally, right? Because you mentioned before, and I think this is a good, it's an apt comparison, the idea that NATO being on Russia's doorstep, especially in Ukraine, is kind of like, you know, their version of the Cuban Missile Crisis, where, I mean, you think about like the way that the Americans view the situation with the Monroe Doctrine, the idea that their backyard is basically the Western Hemisphere and that nobody else is allowed to establish any installations or any troops in that area. Russia feels the same way, right? And I think it's worth sort of like considering what the key events that happened through the 90s and into the 2000s and 2010s with Russia and NATO. So, you know, back when the Soviet Union was dissolving, NATO basically gave a guarantee to the Russians that NATO wouldn't expand any further east than it did, or than it was at that time. And of course, pretty quickly, this promise sort of dissolved, right? Because in 1999, NATO expands to include the Czech Republic, Hungary, and Poland. So you've got Poland on Russia's border. Now NATO is at Russia's doorstep. And then later on, I think it was maybe like 2004 or 2005, the Baltic states joined NATO. So Russia's kind of like starting to look dangerously getting towards being encircled, right? And then I think it was 2008, Georgia and Ukraine sort of begin the process of joining NATO. I forget what the name of the process is, but they begin that process. And so, of course, like Russia freaks out about this as well they should, because it's obviously in their vital security interests to keep NATO sort of at bay and have these neutral countries between it. So it seems like, you know, this NATO expansionism, this liberal hegemony that like has this universalist impulse is kind of provoking Russia. And without really taking a moral stance on like whether this hegemony is, I mean, we obviously don't agree with the liberal aspect of it, but it's really nice to be sort of under the umbrella of the hegemon. So without taking a position, like a moral position on whether that should be happening, it does seem like it kind of runs counter to the West's security interests to kind of be poking them. And the Western response to like what they call Russian aggression is pretty ridiculous. Like it's obviously very ideology laden. I was watching a news report recently where they were just basically saying like Russia is just worried about having a functioning Slavic democracy on its border or whatever, which is, I mean, it's just pure ideology, right? Because NATO's raison d'etre is just basically to fuck with Russia, pretty much. And I mean, if anybody who can't see why Russia wouldn't want that on their doorstep is just completely out to lunch. Like, for them, Operation Barbarossa looms large on the horizon. It's basically like their never again kind of thing, right? So you can understand why the Russians view NATO the way they do, and especially because back in the year 2000, Russia asked to join NATO and join the EU and basically got knocked back for it. So it's pretty clear what NATO is. It's not just a security bloc with the Americans and the Europeans. It's actually a kind of – it's pretty clearly hostile to Russia's interests. So you can understand why they would want this buffer. And the fact is that we really do need Russia in an alliance against China. Driving the Russians into the arms of the Chinese is pretty ridiculous, really. I mean, some of the lower level like policy wonks, the ones that are really shrieking about liberal democracy and our values and whatnot, are kind of under some serious illusions about China. But I think the more senior officials are absolutely aware of it, where when China reaches a certain level of growth, which, you know, frankly, we can't do anything about, then it's going to make the Soviet Union look like peanuts, basically. And the Anglosphere is going to need to ally with the EU. It's probably going to need to bring in Iran and India, and it will definitely need to bring in Russia to act as a counterweight to this Chinese juggernaut. And I mean, even if like one of these actors allies with China, the West is pretty much completely fucked. So isolating Russia is a long-term strategic own goal, and our children will pay the price if that goes too far. And I just saw recently, like in the last day or so, there was a joint statement issued by Russia and China basically saying that they affirm democracy as an unalloyed good, but that democracy is something that basically the West doesn't get to define what it means, kind of thing. So it looks like there's like the beginnings of moves towards the Russians and Chinese embracing each other, which I think is a very, very bad sign. So, I mean, Joel and Prudentialist, what do you guys think about this grand strategy? Is it working? Is it backfiring? What do you think?
Well, I'll jump in here because Prudentialist and I, as I mentioned earlier, we did a stream on Mearsheimer's Tragedy of Great Power Politics, and Mearsheimer's take since the late 90s and early 2000s, he was saying this, was that China was the real peer competitor that the Americans had to worry about, because Mearsheimer's basic theory in a nutshell is that in order to have security in the international system, you want to achieve hegemony. But because power projection across oceans is so difficult, that the best you can kind of hope for is to dominate your particular region and prevent any powers in the other major regions of the earth from gaining hegemony over their particular region. So by being the sole regional hegemon, you can gain a kind of de facto dominance of global politics. this is obviously what the Americans achieved in the late 19th century. They, after defeating the Spanish, they achieved regional hegemony over the Americas and then stuck their nose in Eurasian conflicts to prevent either East Asia or Europe from being dominated by one regional hegemon, whether you look at their opposition to the Germans in both world wars or the Soviet Union in the Cold War or the Japanese in the Second World War, you can see this consistent trend. And he says that basically there's only really three parts of the world other than the Americas that have a strategic interest for the United States, which is Europe, the Persian Gulf, and East Asia. He says Europe and East Asia because these are the two areas of the world other than the Americas that are capable of producing a serious great power. It's not going to be some like great, you know, world player that emerges out of Africa anytime soon or whatever, or Southeast Asia even. And because the Persian Gulf in particular, obviously, there's a bunch of oil there, like in a nutshell. And so for Mearsheimer, he says, like, traditionally, the Americans, their central focus was Europe. And this was because Europe, with whether the two German Reichs that were defeated in the World Wars or the Soviet Union, you had the potential for a peer competitor, a great power that could rival them as essentially a superpower, particularly, you know, if Nazi Germany kind of achieved its objectives. Well, the Soviet Union was a superpower. And obviously they had success there. So the whole production of NATO and the entire reorganization of European politics after the Second World War was essentially done, you know, as Prudentialist said earlier, in order to create dependency for Western Europe upon American security as a check on Russian expansion into Europe. And obviously they were successful in the sense that they were able to extend NATO after the Cold War, gobble up, you know, Baltic states, Poland, various other states. And, you know, they're still kind of got this aggressive posture towards the Russians as a legacy from this time period. But structurally, this no longer makes sense because of the rise of the Chinese. Now, you said before the Americans would need to ally with the Europeans against the Chinese. The thing is, the Europeans don't have the same interest in really contributing a great deal to securing East Asia. They don't even secure themselves. They're reliant upon the Americans for security. The amount of resources and the difficulty of projecting power to East Asia is massive. So they're just simply not going to do anything. They're going to do what Mearsheimer calls buck passing, or it's not just Mearsheimer's concept, but it's a common trope in international relations. So the Europeans can't be relied upon. Now, they have formed a coalition called the Quad, obviously, in East Asia with India, Australia, and Japan. And so that's obviously their kind of Asian version of NATO that they're going to pursue for containing China from achieving regional dominance, or regional hegemony, I should say, in East Asia. But Mearsheimer identified Russia as one of the key partners, because obviously Russia is also in East Asia, right? It does have a massive border with the Chinese. And the Russians, he said, basically, if you're in a region and another state is like the dominant state in that region is trying to assert itself, well, your natural structural interest is to ally with the other medium-sized powers in that region and maybe a foreign regional hegemon in order to balance and create a kind of counterweight against their expansionary power to prevent hegemony forming in your region, just for the simple purpose of security. So Mearsheimer said, well, Europe no longer really matters as much to the Americans. The Europeans aren't really threatening American interests in any significant way. Russia is not the Soviet Union anymore. It's nowhere near the same size economically, nowhere near the same capacity that it once had. And so really, we should be bringing the Russians speaking from an American perspective, onto our side so as to check Chinese expansion, because the Russians will have a natural interest in this. But if they maintain this aggressive posture in Europe, well, as you said before, it's just going to push the Russians into the hands of the Chinese. Now, that maybe can be okay if you feel as though you have the capacity to take on Russia and China together. But even in the Cold War, when China was much weaker, and the Soviet Union, from an economic perspective, had nowhere near the same relative strength to the United States as China does today, even then that was considered intolerable, which was why, you know, Nixon and Kissinger put all the work into, you know, basically bringing the Chinese into the American sphere of influence. So if they couldn't do it then, they definitely can't do it now. And so, as you say, from a kind of from a structural realist point of view, it doesn't really make sense. which is why the only way you can really explain the Americans' action is through, you know, as Prudential said before, through this kind of liberal hegemony paradigm that Russia is an enemy to the liberal world order, and so therefore it must be crushed, it must be kind of encircled and delimited and so forth. And, you know, this raises a question essentially within international relations, which is, okay, so what's really driving states? Because clearly state behavior isn't driven purely through realpolitik, at least not in the American context. Clearly there's a kind of ideological program that's being pursued here that's pursuing other interests than just simply America's national security. So maybe I'll throw it to the Prudentialist as to how you square that circle. Liberal hegemony, to me, it doesn't seem to be purely just an ideological construct. It seems to also serve the interest of the mercantile elite in the United States. There's also the angle, the Zog angle. Mearsheimer and various other realists opposed the Iraq War. They felt as though it was a waste of time and it wasn't in America's national interest, a waste of resources and so forth. And they were proven right in basically what did America gain from it? Almost nothing. And the expenditure was incredible. So when it comes to American foreign policy, I guess, you know, where does this liberal hegemony ultimately come from? Do you see it as just a natural extension of liberal ideology? That's often how Mearsheimer frames it. Or do you see, like, how does it get kind of, how does it impose itself upon the realpolitik demands of the United States so as to kind of drive this wedge between the Americans and the Russians? Or is your reading that actually there is a realpolitik game that is being played here, that the Americans feel as though, well, even though China is the new big dog, that really, if they get out of Europe, that what would emerge in that vacuum is a kind of resurgent German-led, you know, Europe, that if it pursued either, if it kind of became allied with the Russians, could actually pose a serious threat that they would consider to be, you know, impossible to allow to happen. Because it seems as though the Americans are keenly aware that if they were to leave Europe, that you would have remilitarization, that the Germans would be forced into remilitarization. Perhaps this could create a pressure where the European Union would have to kind of centralize authority and start behaving more like a state as opposed to a kind of confederation of states. And would this also then cause problems essentially with the Russians? Like, would the Russians then perhaps be admitted into the EU, do you think, in this scenario? You know, what's like the, you know, what's your kind of analysis of that whole stack, really?
So I'll circle back to some of the points Mike made, and then we'll get to trying to fit the peg into the square peg into that round hole. Yeah, I mean, the issue is that, yes, it seems somewhat self-defeating that you would want to push away a power into the hands of what is your greatest rival. And to me, my gut feeling tells me, based upon the reading that I've done, based on what I look at in the news, is that the United States is in a system where it wants to counter some of the mistakes it made in the past. This is why you saw in 2011, like Barack Obama's pivot to Asia, which I think was probably one of the smarter foreign policy decisions he's ever made. And I'll actually give his administration credit for that. But it also comes at the cost, right? Like, we want to deal with the Chinese, but you're economically interdependent upon them as a consumer economy. At the same time, you allow their elites to come into American universities and you convince American professors to become spies for the Chinese. You deal with massive amounts of espionage, buying up of your property, yet you want to maintain this relationship with them. And you've seen this transition from, say, if they economically liberalize, they may democratize, and we may have a friendlier relationship where it is sort of this cooperative on, you know, just a neoliberal economic framework, which clearly that has not happened. And by forcing the Russians into that general direction, you have really irritated not only your, you know, buck passing European allies, but you've also put yourself in a position where it's not like the Soviet Union at all. At no point in time, as Barry Posen will tell you, and he makes point of this in his book Restraint, A New Foundation for U.S. Grand Strategy, that at no point in time during the Cold War did the Soviet Union ever equal the United States in gross domestic product. It was more or less a 2-to-1 ratio throughout the entire Cold War. That is not the case with the Chinese. Their economy is more or less, in terms of just the raw numbers, very equal to ours, or by ours, the United States writ large. and is close to surpassing it or is predicted to have already surpassed it within the last year or so, depending on which numbers you want to look at. So with that context in mind, you can see how this, you know, NATO expansion, where, you know, originally Secretary of State James Baker promises Boris Yeltsin that we don't plan to expand NATO any further after Germany, sort of that narrative that kind of constantly meets Western media debunking, you know, that Vladimir Putin likes to say, although there are declassified documentation now to actually back that claim up. So you have this pushing further and further eastward, which has now done this. And in fact, not too long ago, you had a German naval chief who was speaking at a security conference in New Delhi, India, saying that, you know, Vladimir Putin deserves respect, we should at least give him that, and that we'll need the Russians to deal with the Chinese sometime in the future. And he gets sacked for it. He's fired for stating what I think is a very obvious and very realistic assessment of the geopolitical situation, whether you're a German or anyone in the West. And so to maybe move now into the direction of, is liberal hegemony just an extension of liberalism? Is liberal hegemony, is there a realpolitik to it? I think that it's a little bit of both, because as you and Nigel, we had kind of talked before this conversation, that I think that there is sort of this synthesis of sorts between various schools, because not one theory can be a catch-all to explain everything, especially in international relations where it's so multi-layered and multifaceted. The concept that I think comes to mind, right, this extension of liberalism, or at least of the Americanite sense of it, you know, it's a social construct. The response that came out of, say, structural realism and neoliberalism in the 1980s and 90s was, well, these, you know, theories, these schools of thought couldn't really predict why the Cold War had ended or why nations, you know, view themselves in a way that they do. Because if the general consensus is that, okay, there's no global sovereign, and therefore the world is anarchic and states must pursue power, they must pursue defense. You know, one of the famous constructivist scholars, Alexander Wendt, wrote famously in 1992, anarchy is what a state makes of it. So how do you perceive yourselves? Because how do you perceive international law? How do you perceive your relationship to other countries? These social constructions play a major role in how a state conducts itself, because, as you know, Oswald Spengler writes in Decline of the West, that the foreign policy and the foreign ministry of a nation in relations to others is a reflection of how it governs itself. And so this liberal hegemony, you know, that we see abroad is very applicable to what we see at home, whether it's progressivism or left of woke, whatever you want to call it, right? And that's how you saw, like, even Glenn Greenwald had wrote for his own paper or his own publications now on Substack, where he was just like, yeah, there are documentations that said that the narrative in Iraq and Afghanistan needs to change, to where it didn't, you know, just become counterterrorism in 2011, 2010. It became about, like, women's rights, human rights, girls' education, stopping female genital mutilation, things like that. And so this social, you know, construction, you know, ordained by the elites or certain mercantile or foreign interests, sort of becomes a part of, you know, the American foreign policy. When you mentioned, like, the Iraq War, for instance, Joel, in fact, Mearsheimer wrote a really good book by, along with Stephen Walt, called The Israel Lobby, where he just says that the amount of influence that that state can put on American foreign policy and domestic politics has made the Middle East worse off, not just because of Iraq and Afghanistan, but because of what we pursue in our relationship to OPEC, or how we have states postured to where now, you know, Iran wants to pursue nuclear weapons. Saudi Arabia, you know, has its Wahhabist structure that we kind of just turn a blind eye to, even though it hurts American soldiers. So, yeah, I think that it's both a mix of realpolitik in the essence that we want liberal democracy because other states that are liberal are primarily going to agree with us ideologically. And if that's the case, then more democracy means less likelihood of war. Which, I mean, if you're one of the largest nuclear-armed states and largest militaries on Earth, then yeah, that probably works to the degree that you can have security blankets and buck passing and no one's going to threaten you. But at the same time, there's also the social construction of it, that we think that this is a moral good, we think that other nations should be like us, and that if we're going to march forward, quote-unquote, on the right side of history, then we should probably do so by whatever means necessary, because if we're in a position that is, like, weak, which I think the United States kind of is from both a cultural and political sense to project it abroad, because you have nations like Germany, wanting to have better relations with Russia. Macron is visiting Putin and Zelensky later next week, I think, and they're also expanding their military budget, then it kind of becomes very clear that this social construction is not benefiting you, but at the same time, you want it to for the interests of your state under this foreign, like, grand strategy. So it's both a self-own, but also I just think that it's so ideologically ingrained in the foreign policy establishment of the United States government that anyone trying to speak anything of reason is left writing for articles like the National Interest or Foreign Policy magazine.
Yeah, you're right to bring in that liberal hegemony has both an ideological and a security strategy element to it. And I mean, what I was saying before about how it's maybe not in the security interests of the West, shall we say, just to encapsulate this block, to drive Russia away by spreading democracy everywhere it can. I think that that's true. And it's especially true from a realist perspective where, you know, realism is in some sense has been captured by democracy itself. Like, it's kind of drunk the liberal democracy Kool-Aid, and it kind of views liberal hegemony as spreading democracy in the sense that democracy is a stabilizing force. But I think if you look at democracy as something less than a stabilizing force, then the security strategy of liberal hegemony actually takes on a different dimension. And I mean, this, it's a bit of a hot take here, so take it for what it's worth. But I think if we look at it like that, it kind of changes, right? Because if you believe that liberalism is a good thing, then liberal hegemony is probably not in America's interest. I mean, first of all, well, you may have like a moral duty to spread liberalism or whatever, but then this, you know, moral duty may actually even outweigh the strategic interest. But even like, you know, if all goes to plan, liberal democracy is spreading democracy everywhere. In the long term, it'll just create economic competitors. Like, you could think of maybe Japan in the 1980s, that where Japan had been obviously, you know, astroturfed into a liberal democracy after World War II. And this started to have, like, you know, serious consequences for it being a like a real economic competitor later down the road. So if you believe that liberalism is like a good and stabilizing force, then, you know, spreading democracy might actually have this sort of, you know, strategic a counter interest dimension to it, because you know, for all the reasons that Mearsheimer states. But if you take the view that liberalism is actually not a good thing and not a stabilizing force, then you can imagine how it would be absolutely in the West's interest to spread that sort of thing, just from a pure, you know, Machiavellian perspective or whatever. I mean, if you consider, you know, liberalism and democracy a kind of disease, then spreading it everywhere is a great way to remain the world hegemon with the ultimate goal. Well, the ultimate goal is China, but the sort of proximate goal being to turn Russia into a democratic society or a liberal society kind of thing, because, you know, that's obviously your main competitor. And you get to say it's the same thing that, like, Friedrich List says about kicking away the ladder. The idea is that, you know, you basically once you've climbed up the ladder to a certain point, then if you get rid of it, then it makes it difficult for your competitor to actually compete, sort of thing. And, you know, this is obviously not the way the West looks at it. This is not a conscious strategy or anything at all. But it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter whether America itself believes that liberalism is bad or good. This strategy still works. So, I mean, you've got like NGOs basically like spreading liberal democracy and kind of like destabilizing countries, turn them into these, you know, itself basically, where, you know, America is basically structural conflict at the societal level enshrined at every institution. This is not a conscious strategy. It's an emergent strategy or an evolved strategy, but it doesn't have to be conscious. It still works. And if democracy, liberal democracy, could be spread to China, this could be very bad for China, because, I mean, America is simply not going to be able to compete with China on an economic footing. It may not even after a certain time, you know, if America wanted to militarily challenge China, it's going to have to do so pretty soon. But if it doesn't do that, basically the window of opportunity will close and there will basically be no way for the West to challenge China really in, you know, however many, a generation or two, let's say. But the Chinese are very, very worried about the idea of ideological exportation into their country from the West, right? There was this document that was leaked a couple of years ago, document number 9 is what it's called. And the issue, and it addresses the issues of, you know, basically ideological infiltration into China, where it lists a number of problems. One of them is, you know, the promotion of constitutional democracy, which undermines the, you know, what they call socialism with Chinese characteristics system of government, or the promotion of universal values that weakens party, like the CCP leadership, right? And all these things, it goes on, you know, promoting civil society and neoliberalism and journalism and all these things, like journalism. I think that's a hilarious, you know, hilarious thing to be worried about. And it really tells you what journalism does for us in the West. But basically, this is the main vector by which the West can challenge China, basically by exporting its own aides into China. So I think that the liberal hegemony actually is a kind of brilliant Machiavellian strategy, even if it's not conscious. So there is that aspect to it as well.
Well, the angle that I was thinking on when I posed the question originally was more that liberalism, insofar as liberalism kind of disables the state from forming a kind of managerial elite that has the structural power to overthrow or delimit and control and subordinate financial power. So in the United States, like the most influential foreign policy think tank is the Council on Foreign Relations. If you watch, Keith Woods made a video about this, I think about a month ago or so, talking about how the Council on Foreign Relations is basically Wall Street run, and it directly serves the interests of the big investment banks on Wall Street. You see someone like a George Soros, who very clearly is conscious of his class interest in his subversive activity in trying to promote open society, as they call it, or like so-called liberal democracy in other states. Why? And Soros makes this clear in a book that he authored, because liberalism prevents the state from really having the capacity to organize itself in such a way that it can't be dominated by big moneyed interests. So when I was saying, is liberalism really in America's national interest, from this perspective of the nation state, spreading liberal democracy to the entire planet, you know, you can make a lot of, I think, structural arguments as to how that's, you know, going to be a highly flawed strategy, and they're kind of they should be more restrained in their foreign policy and so forth. But from the perspective of Wall Street, the United States' national interest is not really what they're too concerned with. They're concerned with their kind of the capacity for them to globalize their power. They don't want any, you know, big foreign powers kind of locking them out of their political process. And obviously, they feel locked out in Russia to an extent, and to a much larger extent in China. Now, obviously, it's not as though in China, you know, BlackRock isn't, you know, got its fingers in a few pies, or that like Russia is, there's no kind of foreign financial interest in the Russian economy. But nevertheless, Putin coming to power, he definitely bitch slapped some oligarchs around and brought things a little bit more under control of the control of the state. And obviously, there's a tradition with, you know, being a former Soviet Union, there is that tradition of a kind of like strong managerial state. In kind of antagonism to, let's say, bourgeois elements. And obviously the same thing is true in China. And obviously the same thing is true in the history of Germany. You know, you're not even just talking about, you know, National Socialist Germany, but even in the pre-World War I Wilhelmian Germany, that kind of like Prussian model of the state or whatever, there was definitely a different attitude taken towards the bourgeois elements in the formation of political power in respect to, you know, the Anglo states, let's say. So the fear of German, Russian, and Chinese managerialism from this perspective makes a lot of sense. And to use the United States as basically like in a parasitic fashion to go about and opening up other political processes and other markets in foreign states that have this kind of managerial membrane. This can, I think, be also construed as kind of part of the rationale behind, you know, the kind of liberal hegemony ethos. But also, there's another aspect to this as well. I mean, I get that it's kind of common parlance in, particularly in Anglophone society, to equate liberalism and democracy. But Mike brought up a good point earlier where he said that the Chinese or the Russians put a joint declaration basically projecting the kind of American definition of democracy, if you will, and saying, you know, we are real democracies, actually. And I mean, if you take the kind of Schmidtian definition of democracy, which is that democracy is the identity of the governed with the government, you can see, particularly in the Chinese state, how within the ideological framework that they have, for them, they are a real democracy. And in fact, I think both Mike and I shared on our telegrams a few weeks ago an empirical study in the United States that showed that when bills go before the Congress, whether they are more or less supported by popular opinion polls has absolutely zero statistical relation to whether they pass or don't pass Congress. So basically what it demonstrated is that it is not a democracy. And Schmidt's point was that liberalism and democracy are kind of fundamentally contradictory, that even though they have a kind of problematic relationship and they can never really coexist among one another. And essentially what it comes down to, in a nutshell, I mean, you can watch my video on Schmidt's crisis of parliamentary democracy to get the more elongated explanation. But really what it comes down to is the fact that democracy, insofar as it has the, you know, the Rousseauian notion of the general will, this process of identification of the governed with their government requires a kind of collective identity to be formed. In other words, a kind of homogeneous majority needs to become self-aware of itself, has to become aware of itself as a particular identity, as a particular culture, as a particular people, and then it has to give that identity to the state in order for the state to then become authorized by its co-identification and also to the law itself. And this identification between the homogeneity of the people and their reflection in the law and the state is what constitutes democracy, whereas liberalism, through its emphasis on, you know, as Mearsheimer says, liberalism is basically the idea that we can't come to agreement on first principles, and so we're going to establish a procedural kind of deferral of making any final decision as to what our identity is as a state or as a people. And so it emphasizes minority rights, it emphasizes the separation of powers. And so in a certain sense, for Schmidt, liberalism is actually the prevention of democracy ever fully forming, because if democracy was to truly form, it would be tyrannical. It would be this collectivist, nationalist, socialist, all these different words that they use to describe things that are not liberalism and apparently not democracy. Populist, even, we see with the Atlantic Council, like NATO's favorite think tank, that, you know, they see populism as the great threat to liberalism. And Alex Jones, I remember listening to him on his InfoWars show, was scratching his head one show saying, how could populism be against liberalism? This is just ridiculous. But it makes perfect sense if you understand Schmidt, because what they're saying is that, well, a popular movement can assert some kind of homogenous identity that will then shut down minority rights. Say, well, you guys are in the minority. You guys don't share our identification with the state. So your concerns don't get to get intermixed up into the state. Whereas a liberal democracy, particularly the United States par excellence, is minority rule. It's the rule of, the tribe and the bourgeois and blacks and homosexuals and so forth. It's the rule of everyone but the homogenous majority. It's the rule of everyone but real America, basically. And so I think this is an important inflection point for us to kind of focus on, is what's happening here with this move into multipolarity is this kind of hegemonic liberal definition of democracy itself is being challenged, and a different kind of world order is being proposed by the Russians and the Chinese, in which it's a kind of more genuine nationalism, a more genuine respect of the sovereignty of nations, although it also is problematic. I mean, I remember when I posted on Telegram saying I can kind of understand if the Russians were to invade Ukraine, the rationale behind it. People were saying, you know, how dare you? You know, you're supposed to be a nationalist. What about the poor Ukrainian nationalists? And I said, yeah, well, I do sympathize with the Ukrainian nationalists, but unfortunately, there's a kind of great power process that's kind of, and they're kind of in the middle of these two superpowers, or great powers at least, jostling for position. and preventing a war between the Americans and the Russians is, I think, higher priority in terms of world peace than Ukrainian self-determination. But it seems as though, even though there are these inconsistencies, perhaps you could argue, that nevertheless, the model for the world that the Russians and the Chinese are putting forward is one in which there isn't some hegemonic ideology, but instead a kind of, you could say maybe a kind of hegemonic nationalism, if you will, but at least like a kind of genuine self-determination of nations and, you know, to make up the world order, as opposed to this kind of human rights individualism rhetoric. As Mearsheimer pointed out in a lecture of his that I posted on Telegram the other day, he was saying this kind of two strands of liberalism. And he considered himself a particularist liberal, and he was arguing against what he called universalist liberalism. And he said, you know, within liberalism, there are these two attitudes you could take. On the one hand, universalist liberalism is that, well, if liberalism is correct, that every individual has certain inalienable rights, then all human beings on Earth have these rights. And so, therefore, if any of them are deprived of them, then that's a problem for liberalism. Liberalism has to kind of spread itself over the entire face of the earth in order to ensure every single human being has these rights equally. But then he says there's also the particular strand in liberalism, which, as I said before, is this idea that we can't agree on first principles. And so Mearsheimer said, well, even if we in the United States or Australia or Britain or whatever want to have liberal states, we have to learn how to agree that, well, not every other state in the world is going to agree with us on these first principles. So from this liberal stance, if China wants to be communist or whatever, that's their problem. And it's not up to us to go and liberate the Chinese people to, you know, give them the right to chop their dicks off and, you know, have gay marriages and, you know, diversity, immigration and all this kind of stuff. So I think, you know, it poses interesting questions that now that the American world order is being challenged, now its ideology can be challenged, but not just from the outside, from like an opposing ideology, but from within, like using like Mearsheimer's critique of liberalism from within, or the kind of Schmidtian critique of liberalism and democracy's supposed contradiction and so forth, that it seems like the there's probably a lot of adherence of, particularly in the Chinese state, but you know, also with the Russians, is a kind of undermining of this hegemonic ideal. So, you know, I'm curious what you guys think about that. Do you see that as a viable path forward? And also, secondarily, like what's your take on Ukraine? Because I'm not like too aware on Ukraine. Maybe the Prudentialist knows a little bit more. Like, do you see any authenticity to Ukrainian nationalism, or is, you know, some people say that it's just like a psyop by NATO to turn them against the Russians and they're a fake country. I don't really buy that, but so maybe, yeah, I'd like to hear your thoughts on all of that.
I just wouldn't mind jumping in very quickly, and then I'll pass it over to the Prudentialist because I want to hear what he's got to say on this and the idea of nationalism and Ukraine more generally. But I would like to defend what it is that you were saying there on Telegram about, you know, you can understand why the Russians would jump into Ukraine, and that can be squared with a kind of nationalism, where I think the idea of like the self-determination of every little state really does open up the world to a situation where nationalism can't exist. Like, you can imagine the difficulties that would be faced by like the NRX idea of like, you know, a worldwide consortium of nation of city states. Like, that's a ripe world for liberal hegemony to come back. So I mean, like, when NATO defends the right of states to determine themselves, you know, it says we're defending the right of states to self-determination, but what they're really defending is the right of states to determine themselves strictly according to a framework determined by NATO, right? So in other words, it's like self-determination, except when we determine otherwise. It's kind of like that old Oscar Wilde quote, you know, like, I can resist anything except temptation, except they're not kidding, you know what I mean? So it's like, you know, if Eastern Ukraine determined that, you know, true autonomy for itself lay in becoming a Russian rump state, would NATO accept this? Obviously not. So talking about the right to self-determination is not really a thing in reality in international politics for everybody. I mean, obviously subsidiarity is kind of at the heart of the right. You know, the idea, let each man perform the sacrifices according to his own right. This is an idea as old as the hills. But thinking that each state can just be kind of like left to determine its own destiny is kind of idiotic, really. I mean, the reality is that minor powers get swallowed up by major powers. This is how it is. And frankly, it's probably how it should be. So instead of talking about like self-determination, I think we should talk more about the idea of noblesse oblige. I mean, there's no alternative to great power politics. So the measure that by which, you know, it should be judged is not self-determination, but maybe paternalism. You know, does the great power act toward the minor power like a father would towards his son? Like, does Russia sort of take a paternalist stance towards Ukraine? Does it have Ukraine's highest interests at heart? Does it enable the people of Ukraine to express their distinct cultural identity as, you know, existing within its sphere? Does it enable this idea of, you know, let each man do his own thing, or does it hinder it? And this is, I think, a better moral scale to judge hegemony on. But yeah, with that, I'll throw it over to Prudentialist and get his take.
So on like the grounds of Ukrainian nationalism, I don't think that it's sort of the, oh, it's a psyop kind of deal, because if you wanted a good take on sort of the political and ethnic situation of Ukraine and its people, as well as its government, especially in a democratic sense, the 2010 election, I would just recommend anyone in the audience to look up a map of the electoral results where Viktor Yanukovych got elected, and it was very narrowly. And it was a pretty firm divide between Eastern and Western Ukraine, where Western Ukraine voted for against Yanukovych, whereas Eastern Ukraine, that was far more ethnic Russian, that had a stronger sense of Russian identity or belonging, voted for Yanukovych. So there are Ukrainian nationalists, and I would be very wary for anybody to say, oh, it's a psyop, or oh, it's, you know, fake or astroturfed. But I mean, like, these sort of, you know, creations of a national identity, or even like an ethnogenesis of sorts, to sort of, you know, borrow that term, does exist. Like in Kazakhstan, there are actual Kazakh nationalists, despite the fact that, you know, the area of Kazakhstan, the steppe, is home to, you know, hundreds of different ethnic groups and languages that have been spoke that have no idea of a central democratic authority. But I mean, I think it's the December 86 revolt in Kazakhstan, where, you know, the Russians sort of put down a lot of Kazakh protests and whatnot and ethnic groups. That kind of formulates that identity, and that's why there's still, to this day, you know, ethnic Kazakhs, quote unquote, because there are so many different ethnic groups, have that animosity towards like the Russian diaspora that was there throughout the Russian Empire and later the Soviet Union. So it's not to say that it doesn't exist, because it certainly does, and I can sympathize with them. The issue, though, right, with this like great power politics over Ukraine is that to me it kind of reiterates that, you know, the whole Budapest Memorandum of 95 about nuclear disarmament and the promises of security, which even then the various presidents and those that were aiming for denuclearization, it never got ratified by the Senate. There was no way for the Americans to enforce it. That's sort of been the excuse there, despite the fact that there were promises made, right? And I kind of like the point that Mike made about this sort of like noblesse oblige, because if you were going to take this sort of paternalistic role over other nation states, then, you know, you should probably value your word. And this is something that even sort of establishment kind of realist, but mainly neoconservative thinkers like George Friedman have talked about. Like, when you're not following up on that, it doesn't matter what your interests are or what you say in treaties. Those actions stay with you, which is why the value of an American promise has been decreasing quite rapidly since 2008, whether it's the invasion of Georgia, the American financial crisis, then the inability to back up certain claims in Eastern Europe at the time after colored revolutions. It kind of illustrates that they're not following up on this. And I kind of agree with what Joel had made. He made an excellent point with the Schmidtian view. Like, if there's no actual democratic aspect wherein a singular group of people under a shared identity can express themselves and rule over, then it becomes very difficult for you to really do anything as the majority, or as I think Scott Greer calls them, heritage Americans, right? Because now the United States has basically been turned into this strip mall of an economic zone wherein, you know, capital and other foreign interests can more or less determine policy under the guise of, you know, one of the most well-spent defense departments on Earth. So, I mean, that does play a significant role, and I'm inclined to agree. But the other thing that I'll throw this out here, because this has been a debate that's been going on for like 45 years, is that Kenneth Waltz, who's a realist international relations scholar, he had argued in for two things. He had said that bipolarity, i.e. at the time the United States and the Soviets, generated a better essence for world peace because it's two powers that are balancing against one another, and it allows nations and their identities and their economies to sort of make the decision of who they want to be allied with, and in turn be under sort of that security or to pursue their own security under that umbrella. But the other thing that he adds to that is also about the proliferation of nuclear weapons. And the fact that he says that because the more nations have nuclear weapons, the likelihood of them being used is reduced because, you know, if one country decides to turn the key and press the red button, you've more or less, it's not ever going to be just one nuclear weapon that goes off, right? It's not a singular exchange. It would be pretty, you're inviting the rest of the world to do so, which reduces it. And this has been an ongoing debate for years, right? But I think it kind of illustrates that if you're not willing to be a nuclear armed state or be willing to pursue your own avenue of power, it leaves you very vulnerable to doing so. I mean, for instance, when the Soviet Union fell and Kazakhstan got independence, Kazakhstan had the fourth largest nuclear arsenal on Earth for a short period of time, and it was eventually disarmed. But before it was, I mean, Muammar Gaddafi of Libya, like, flew over there and told the leadership, and he told Nazarbayev, he's just like, listen, we were, you know, we've got a Muslim majority in both countries. We should have, like, sort of this, like, Muslim Arab, like, I will personally fund for a nuclear weapons program. And when nations don't have the ability to pursue them, you kind of have that function where other nations can invade and such. So the fact that there is the sense of self-determination and pursuing of these policies, it does make it very easy for you to fall into the trap of great power politics. But because there is no, you know, singular direction in American democracy, and because, and I think it's either Schmidt or Spangler who had said that as democracies become more heterogeneous, it just becomes basically a racialized coalitionism of determining governments and having sort of a patron system for those who have done it and got you in power, then you're not going to be accomplishing anything. You're beholden to the interests of other people, which is why you get like Steve Saylor saying, you know, invade the world, invite the world. And American foreign policy is like that nowadays. Like, for an example, not related to Ukraine or Russia, but, you know, there's a civil war going on in Ethiopia. And then there's also the ongoing issue of Egypt pressing on the Americans' like jacket about this dam that the Ethiopians have been building with Chinese money because it can affect the flow of the Nile. And our policy is being determined by, you know, Ethiopian, you know, interest groups inside of the country of Ethiopian Americans telling the American government how to govern itself. So I'm very much inclined to agree with what Joel had brought up with the Schmidtian model, because, you know, there is no base population, or, you know, they try to suppress it and silence it, which we've seen, you know, in the 2020 election, and we will probably see it in other elections in the future as well. So when it comes back to the foreign policy thing, you are seeing a lot of self-defeating aspects based upon a social construction, but also based upon these old ideas of maintaining American primacy. And this is all happening in the emergence of a multipolar world order, because the European Union and those European states are beginning to recognize, okay, the Americans can't maintain unipolarity. We should probably pursue our own interests, which is why you're seeing more European talk with Iran and China and Russia and having their own European defense autonomy. Russia's beginning to assert itself in other areas and are kind of recognizing what kind of conflict in the 21st century it would look like. They were hosting naval exercises a few days ago outside of the Irish exclusive economic zone, and they were right on top of some of the most, you know, important undersea cables for internet to function across the continent. And if, you know, they're still struggling to stop sharks from biting those. I think easily an anti-submarine ordnance device could take out those cables if they wanted to. So it kind of illustrates what war would look like in the 2020s. And China, of course, is expressing their own, you know, they're using their own currency diplomacy. They've made more investments in Africa and South America than any other country in the world in the last 20 years. A multipolar world order is inevitable, but the Americans are still pursuing it in this sort of unipolar fashion that they can still somehow maintain it, which I think, as we can tell, you know, when there's no real interests at the head of government, because that base population no longer has the ability to exert its own influence, it becomes, you know, able to have so many subversive and self-destructive elements inside of it.
This is why I think the mercantile angle is that I brought up earlier is integral to understanding all of this, because, I mean, from the perspective of a mercantile elite, you want to prevent real democracy in the Schmidtian sense from forming, because then that authorizes, as I said before, a kind of managerial elite to take control of the state and subordinate the economy and all other aspects of, like the kind of all other kind of key aspects of society to the national interest. And clearly they don't want this. Clearly they like their parasitical relationship. They like their capacity to, I mean, it's not technically called corruption when they do it in DC, they call it lobbying or whatever, but it's basically the same thing, right? They like the way, and obviously the same thing with the Zog aspect. I mean, it's very obvious why if you're only, 1 to 2% of the population, why you wouldn't want majority rule in the country that you're, you know, getting given $150 billion to set up your defense for or whatever with your like diaspora lobbying in all these powerful positions within like the host country or whatever. So liberalism in the sense of minority rights, it clearly benefits these particular parasitical elements. And it seems as though the United States is just this complex of various parasites that have kind of attached themselves to this system. And so its capacity to even know what its national interest is anymore is completely defeated, because in any kind of political movement that did try to figure out what the American national interest is, they get lambasted as like the, you know, like the Hitler 2.0, like the worst thing to ever happen ever, and like they're going to kill everyone, and like this is a total disaster, like liberal hysteria. But like trying to get beyond this, though, I think that we do have an opportunity to kind of use multipolarity in an interesting way, because it proposes a real ideological challenge in these international establishments. So for example, with Ukrainian nationalism, if the, like you were saying before about how the Americans, basically, they don't have any, they've lost so much credibility because they made so many promises they couldn't keep. Like you brought up Georgia, like they were flirting with admitting Georgia into NATO in the mid 2000s. The Georgians got all uppity with the Russians, thinking that the Americans had their back. And then the Russians just invade and the Americans don't do shit. So, you know, when that kind of thing happens, or when you think like when they went to Afghanistan, and they're going to build their democracy there for the Afghan people to be liberated. And, they're promoting feminism and all this rubbish in Afghanistan. And like literally before they even got all their planes out, the Taliban were already back in charge. You know, this the legitimacy of what they're doing is completely devoid. So I don't really blame people who maybe don't know too much about the Ukrainian dynamic, who say, well, Ukrainian nationalism is probably just BS, because like, why would they believe the Americans at this point? Like when America says these people have a right to self-determination and they're getting pushed around by one of America's enemies, who's going to believe them? They've been so hyperbolic and so ridiculous. It just seems like they're saying, they're trying to use, you know, trans rights for Ukrainians as an excuse to pursue great power conflict, as opposed to any kind of legitimate moral claim. And so it's very important that in the international system, to have that kind of moral legitimacy that I think the Americans once did have to an extent, their capacity to negotiate the world order after the Second World War, regardless of what your position on the Second World War is. Clearly they had the trust of various different nations to act in good faith so that they could kind of set that up. And there was no capacity for the Americans to pull off some kind of grand, you know, international agreements in the same way that they once were able to do now, because like you said, that they you can't trust them. They'll say one thing one day and one thing the next, and their ideology is this kind of paradoxical, you know, self-defeating nonsense. But yeah, I think, I mean, I know Mike wants to say something, but I think we should, Mike, jump in. But I also just want to make sure before we finish this conversation, I really want to get the hot takes at the end. What's going to happen in Ukraine? Like, what's your prediction? I made a bold prediction on Telegram based upon reading a kind of a bunch of, you know, Western experts, let's say, like credentialed experts on Russian politics, Eastern European politics, international relations scholars that said there was a lot of cause to believe that the Russians would engage, excuse me, in some kind of military action in Ukraine, not necessarily a full invasion. And I saw Caspian Report put out a video the other day talking about this. There's a lot of reasonably credible people that think that it's a very real possibility. But then at the same time, I talked to a friend of mine who lives in Kiev, who was saying the Ukrainian media base and the Ukrainian government, I've seen, dismissing it as just Western hyperbole. The Russian media is not really amping its people up for war, but claiming that the Western media and the West are like playing games. And so it's a very confusing situation. In some sense, it almost looks like a giant game of chicken to me, in a way, where like the Ukrainians want to come off like they think everything's chill because they don't want to be brought to the negotiating table by the Russians. The Russians probably don't really want to invade or anything because it would be a nightmare to actually try and pull that off. But they want to flex their muscle a little bit to put pressure on the Ukrainians and the Americans to, you know, take their interests into consideration. And also, I guess, some of the other European states, you know, they want certain guarantees because of their kind of overarching concerns. And the Americans, like you see, Biden said the other day that I think Putin will invade. And there's like, you know, like the Congress is passing all of these like sanctions. If they do something, then we're going to put all these sanctions on you, blah, blah. So like, it's a very strange situation. I don't remember anything like this really happening before, where you have like this complex of different narratives from like, I don't remember in my life ever the American president telling a sovereign leader that they're about to be invaded and then a sovereign leader of another state telling them that they're full of shit, which basically happened the other day, apparently, when Biden was on the phone with Zelensky or whatever. So I'd like to get your take on that, but Mike, I know you want to say some stuff, and so maybe jump in.
Yeah. Well, I like that the conversation has one of the threads that's kind of running through it here is the divide between democracy and liberalism. And I'll just reiterate that, like, anybody that's listening really does need to go back and watch that video that Joel did on Schmitt's Crisis of Parliamentary Democracy. It's about a half an hour video, very much well worth it. This is a great book, and he makes some good points here, where I think that the thing is, ultimately, democracy and liberalism are tied together in that they at least share a genealogical relationship, where, you know, basically mass democracy is the child of liberalism. Approximately, it's the child of bourgeois liberalism, but you can even trace it back to revolutionary liberalism, which I did in one of my recent Telegram posts. But the fact is that they are different things. They do share this tension, and Schmitt is right to point it out. And I think we should also point out that these things work differently. That is, democracy and liberalism they have a different effect in the anarchic situation of international politics than working within the nation itself. So if you think of democracy within nations, it kind of works as this like singular homogeneous block that is actually it's a lot less, you know, it's a lot more peaceful than the kind of like liberalism argy bargy, you know, the never ending debate between interests that never gets the deferral, that never gets resolved into a decision. So democracy kind of works well in terms of like promoting peace within nations. But if you think of the international situation as a kind of, you know, under a unipolar hegemon, as a kind of democracy between nations, where you get this, like I said, the kind of unipolarity, that is not a peaceful situation. And that's what we see right now. That's what we've seen since the Cold War. Like, you know, there have been just a huge number of like international conflicts under that. But when you get this kind of like heterogeneous balance of powers that Prudentialist, you mentioned before, I think the name of the thinker was Walt or something. Kenneth Waltz, yeah. Under a kind of multipolar world, where you get a situation where you know, nations basically can choose the umbrella that they want to sit under. To some extent, they can choose, and that actually makes things a bit more peaceful under this situation. So it's kind of like liberalism that is the heterogeneous interests at the international scale kind of works better for peace promotion, but a homogeneous block of interest works very well within nations. And this kind of like, you know, it throws a bit of a wrench into the idea of, you know, democratic peace theory. And we can kind of tie this in with what I said before about liberal hegemony as a destabilizing force. The fact is that a multipolar world is probably more peaceful than a hegemonic world. And you can, again, I think what it comes down to is the idea that you mentioned as well about mutually assured destruction. You know, you mentioned with nuclear weapons, and the idea that every power, if not every nation, is armed. I mean, this is an old Germanic idea that we like it, you know, as in the Anglosphere. It makes sense that every man should be armed. It's, you know, the basis of the First Amendment, or sorry, Second Amendment in the States. And one of the interesting things that I think the realists come up with in this respect is that nationalism itself acts as a kind of stabilizing force. You know, again, this is sort of like contra to everything that liberal democracy is telling us, but nationalism is this sort of, you know, if every country is armed, if every country sort of like has its own nationalism, that, you know, basically people sort of, you know, the different powers kind of respect borders a little bit more, right? Because every nation has the ability to essentially resist the incursion of liberal ideology or any ideology, and that this actually makes for a more stable world. And I think this is something that we really need to talk about, and really it's an idea that we need to popularize, that we can take from offensive realism and Mearsheimer himself, is that nationalism is a stabilizing force. And basically the ideologues that are running the liberal democratic order have it exactly backwards, that, you know, democracy promotion all over the world is basically a recipe for the world on fire, whereas nationalism itself, I mean, the world's never going to be a peaceful place, but, you know, this is the best that we can kind of do. And this is something that might sort of help us at home with kind of selling what it is that we're selling.
No, I actually agree with a lot of what you just said there, Mike. I think that that's a very valid point. And I think that as we enter that multipolarity, and I think that's an inevitable part about it, that we're going to start seeing these various different blocks, and almost as if sort of like a global Congress system, if sort of this like nation state, you know, framework continues to go, because there's also like the you know, like the World Economic Forum and like the globalist aspect to it, which I can see like the state apparatus existing to either A, make it work in its favor, or B, just like go along with it. Like there's a lot of Chinese cooperation, for instance, with like the World Economic Forum or like the COP26 climate goals. But what is China doing to achieve that? They're like, they're going to spend $612 billion to build nuclear reactors. They've covered mountains with solar panels, and they're trying to shut down their coal nuclear power plants. But I mean, they still view themselves as a uniquely like Han Chinese state. They're, you know, investing elsewhere to get what they need to bypass American sanctions and to go forward with that. So I think as the multipolarity goes down, like, of course, nations are going to pursue hegemony, and they're going to try and pursue their own paths. But I do think that it provides a way to reduce the threat in that sort of direction. So, it's a very good observation to make.
Yeah, but what's your take on Ukraine? Are the Russians going in or what?
That's the thing, right? Is that like the Americans keep pushing and pushing and pushing that there's going to be this invasion. Even President Zelensky has said, "I am the president of Ukraine. I am based in this country." And he apparently, allegedly, to the phone call, he had to tell Biden to calm down, that they weren't going to be. There wasn't going to be an invasion. And every time that there's like an American news article about it, like there was one by Reuters like last week where they're like, oh, the Russians are bringing blood up to there, which, you know, signifies that they're going to attack because you need blood to help with as a field medic. But if you're going to deploy that number of troops there, of course your medical corps is going to be coming along with blood. Like, that's not unexpected. And it feels rather hyped up. Plus the source came from like anonymous higher up U.S. sources. Like I mentioned, Edward Luttwak at the very beginning of our conversation, he says
great author, by the way. Everyone should read his book on the coup d'etat. He basically wrote like a how-to if you're a, you know, some kind of African general or something, how are you gonna, like, how to do a coup d'etat with all this historical analysis of various coup d'etats in history. And it's one of the, I was gonna make a video on it. I never did. Maybe I should have. Maybe another time I will. But that book is brilliant. A lot of red pills in there. But anyway, sorry to cut you off. But go on.
Oh no, you're good. He also wrote a really great book about the grand strategy of the Roman and Byzantine empires. Fantastic read if you want some ancient history about ancient statecraft. But his argument is that there's not enough troops in Belarus and on sort of the Russian-Ukraine border. As well as where Russia has seized territory in Ukraine, to really make a substantial invasion effort to do so. And I'm inclined to agree with that take. The caveat is that I don't think if something's going to happen, it won't be because the Russians do it. You have the Americans and by extension NATO putting more troops in Poland, Lithuania, Estonia, and the Baltic states. There's now a carrier group in the Baltic Sea, which, keep in mind, the Baltic Sea is very important to Russia because there's the military and naval port of Kaliningrad up there. While at the same time, you've got the Crimea, which gives you access to the Black Sea, which gives you access to the Mediterranean. These things are essential, right? In the same way that like Syria is essential to Russia, because like the port of Tartus gives you a warm water port for the Russian Navy. I don't think if anything is to happen, I do not think it will be caused by the Russians. And I don't think that Russia wants to just take over Ukraine and occupy it. I don't know if they have the capacity and the forces to do so in the wake of, say, sanctions. And I mean, what I would presume would be a military response that invokes NATO to try and liberate Ukraine. But I do think that if anything happens, the Russian in-game strategy would be to pursue access to Crimea at all costs. And what makes this so terrifying is that the Russian government has a first use policy that if Russian sovereignty or territorial integrity is ever violated by a foreign foe, that like nuclear weapons are on the table to deny that area to them, which makes this so scary. So I guess my hot take prediction for this is that at the current moment, the Russians are not the aggressor, and that if anything is to happen, it will be instigated primarily by American and NATO forces and Russia's.
So like, blue balls. So basically, yeah, nothing.
I know.
No content for us. No content. World War III canceled again.
World War III canceled until some, diverse drone pilot wants to be a hero, I think. But, you know, wars have been started over smaller mistakes. But I do think that the Russian endgame, and by the fact that even today at the start of the Winter Olympics, that Putin has already, you know, signed like, you know, more strategic investment and agreement with the Chinese, kind of tells you that the American diplomatic call to like tell China, Russia to back off, you know, they're calling the Chinese to tell Russia like, hey, like tell them to back off the Ukraine thing. It didn't work. So the fact that you kind of have the two larger military blocks in there, I don't think NATO could take on not only just like Russian military equipment, but also like Chinese economic responses. Cause I mean, already Russia is one of the largest wheat exporters. And the prices of like ammonia and urea and fertilizers gone through the roof, and China's been stopping exports to maintain their own strategic reserve. I mean, at that point, all you got to do is crunch the already crumbling supply line and supply, you know, routes that we have. You could easily kind of starve out the West through high prices, so to speak, to where it's politically unviable to wage war. So it's this really tense game of chicken, and that's really my position here. Until there's a brokered agreement or there's some kind of talk, which is why I'm hopeful to see what Macron does, I think right now all we're doing is just seeing a bunch of saber rattling, a bunch of, you know, rulers being taken out as they whip out the thing from their pants, all of which, right, is dangerous because the security dilemma, right? Anytime that you do so and you're not clearly communicating your needs or your desires to the other state, there's no way to interpret it, which can lead to war. But I think it's a game of chicken, and the Americans are trying so damn hard to give reason to do something where even the Ukrainian president is like, no, fuck off. Like, this isn't true. So well, I think the Americans are definitely bluffing.
I don't think the Americans have any capacity to do anything in Ukraine. I mean, It's on Russia's border. So, like, if the Russians were to go in, the Americans could maybe try and support, Ukrainian forces and resistance, and maybe send in some spec ops or send them some weapons or something, supplies of other kinds. But I just don't really see any real capacity for the Americans to, like, go into Ukraine proper and actually wage an all-out war against the Russians and win. The commitment that they would need to do that is insane. Like, it would be like, hundreds of thousands of men projecting. I just don't see it as rational. I think the Americans pretty much ruled it out at first. And then once they realized that the Europeans weren't taking it as seriously as they wanted, then have started to act a little bit more tough in like the last few weeks. So that my impression was they were trying to at first paint it as though, oh, the Russians might do something and we can't do anything about it except slap sanctions on them, and tried to lean on the Germans and so forth to like commit to, shutting down Nord Stream 2 if they invade, or like putting some threats on the table. And the Europeans weren't willing to do that because that would literally destroy the European economy in the middle of winter, having an energy shortage. I mean, that's a disaster. So I think that this is their second attempt at trying to disincentivize something.
To also put in there, right, with the Europeans, this is like the Americans and the UK withdrew their staff from their embassies in Kiev, burned everything, and then the rest of Europe was like, no, we're not doing this. And also the biggest indicator of why I don't think there's going to be like a really major invasion or a really major conflict is that if things were that serious and if there were actual plans to do something or to instigate something, the Americans would have already evacuated or sent their guys home from the embassy in Moscow. That to me kind of indicates, because you would recall your diplomats, you would recall your staff, you would burn all your sensitive documents, and then like if they wanted to seize it, they could, but nothing would be available to them. I think
the chances of the Americans of doing anything like militarily is basically zero. It doesn't make any sense, like from a strategic standpoint either.
The fact that it's so unilateral.
What's the chances of the Russians doing something? Because there's a few dynamics at play here. Because the longer that the Russians wait, it seems as though the closer the Ukrainians move toward the West. If you watch the Caspian Reports video on this, or if you read, I posted a few things on Telegram last week, a week before, from, different international relations theorists kind of like, imagining how would it go down if they were going to go in. And basically what they said was that the Russians wouldn't come in and try and occupy the country. They felt as though it would be more like a kind of strategic attack, maybe like encircle Kiev or take certain territories in the south, like try to take Odessa or something like this, and then try and bring the Ukrainians to the table for negotiations to try and put into their constitution, like, you want your territories back, we'll all pack up and go home if you promise that you'll never join NATO or the EU, or if you provide constitutional guarantees for political independence to like the Donbass regions, or things of this nature, or like a kind of hybrid constitution where Eastern Ukraine elects the president and Western Ukraine elects the prime minister, or something that would give the Russians peace of mind that Ukraine was never going to become like a fully fledged member of the West, because the Russians feel as though they can't negotiate with the Zelensky government. Negotiations completely broke down, and so now they're trying to, basically with the negotiations that happened, they're basically trying to put pressure on the Americans and the Europeans to try and bring Ukraine to the table, or to give them direct guarantees or whatever. But it seems like the Russians want something here, so they definitely want the threat of invasion, it seems, to kind of still be lingering in the West. So maybe they might play it down to their own people, but I think they know that if push came to shove, that they could do something very serious in Ukraine, that ultimately they have way better tech than the Ukrainian military does, way better air force. Like, I don't know if the Ukraine really has much of an air force. Like, they've got so many advantages. Occupying the territory would be very difficult. Obviously, all occupations are difficult, even when you have that asymmetry. But they would be able to do very serious damage. And, you know, so I think, and then the Ukrainians are kind of sitting on an internal political powder keg of all these different factions within the state as well. So if they were to be able to put pressure on the central government to kind of, for it to collapse, then all hell could break loose in the country and it becomes totally unpredictable. So it seems as though like the Russians are saying, rather than saying we're going to invade, occupy and like annex Ukraine or something, it seems more as though the threat is we can just fuck up Ukraine and just make it ungovernable. We can basically Ukraine's totally dependent on Russian energy. They can cut that off and like just bring the Ukrainian economy to a standstill if they want, even without invading. They've got so many options on the table to fuck with Ukraine. So it's almost like they're kind of saying, you know, we're the real big dicks here. So you better like put some respect when we send our diplomats to you to try and set up a meeting. You better come to that meeting and negotiate with us seriously. Like don't treat us like we don't matter, because that seems to be more the impression that I'm getting from what I've seen.
Like with the asymmetry, like the Ukrainian economy is already a huge problem, and that a good chunk of their foreign debt is already owed to Russia. So that gives them the significant leverage here. While the U.S. is trying to like escalate things and sort of play the chicken here, like we kind of talked about, think about the things that Russia has done in the past couple of months, not just with the Ukraine situation, but sort of in the region writ large. It, with like the Belarus-Poland migrant crisis, what happened? Like Russian TTU bombers were flying over, Russian paratroopers were deployed, sort of the situation had Russian backing. So like this saber rattling from the Americans about deploying troops to Poland wasn't going to amount to anything. And now there's troops, you know, within Belarus and within that Russian-Belarusian border, also close to Ukraine. Lukashenko's not going anywhere despite, you know, attempted color revolution. So that kind of helps solidify his position there. I detest the Peter Zeihan argument that like Russia wants to like get back territorial borders from a certain year. All they need to do right now is wither away American influence to the western part of the continent, but also to secure what are strategic needs. You've got a guy in Belarus that, you know, is going to be on your side because he's dependent upon you. You've more or less ensured that that Crimea is not going back to like the western part of Ukraine. And on top of that, right, like what are the Americans doing? They're just trying to buy time. They're already like getting other countries to send weapons over to the Ukrainians. And even Boris Johnson had to quickly correct himself and saying like, yeah, we're sending lethal weapons. Then he had to rephrase it and say defensive lethal weapons to sort of make it clear that this isn't being antagonistic, which is why I think that like the end game here isn't conflict. If it is, it's going to be under pretenses not started by Russia, but between the, you know, the ability that the Russians can deploy forces quicker, the Russian Navy has like the de facto, you know, area of power in the Caspian, as well as, you know, along that border, despite where NATO is, that I think that whatever happens is the Russians can negotiate exactly like you had mentioned, Joel, whatever sort of concessions they want here, because I don't think anyone has the political will to pull the trigger and actually go with it.
Okay, well, I think this we should probably bring this to a close, but thanks so much for coming on. Mike, do you want to maybe give some final remarks here yourself? I think that pretty much covers all the bases I wanted to cover.
Yeah, I think that we did cover a lot of ground that was good. As far as Ukraine and what's going to happen there, I think it's unpredictable right now. Even the Russians, I don't think, know what the Russians are going to do, because there's so many balls in the air and there's so many conflicting timelines. Like, you know, on the Russians kind of have to move soon if they're going to move at all, because number one, the ground is going to thaw pretty soon in a month or two, and that's going to make invasion pretty much impossible, or at least very difficult. But on the other hand, invasion may not be necessary. You know, it may just simply be a conflict, and it might be, if there is a conflict, it might be over kind of in a flash or whatever. But they also have to move soon, because, you know, the continued sort of integration of Ukraine with NATO is a big problem, because they don't want that Article 5 declaration to kick in, because that'll pretty much, either what will happen is they'll never be able to do anything in Ukraine again, or, you know, if they do something, you know, who knows, depending on military, you know, American political and military will, it could actually be the master stroke that kind of undoes NATO if they can't enforce Article 5. But, you know, in the near term, if you look at, I think Prudentialist was right to bring up that you haven't seen the pulling out of diplomats from Russia. On the other hand, as well, you also haven't seen the kind of expected propaganda blitz that you would think would happen sort of running up to an invasion. So it doesn't look like they're actually moving towards that. But, you know, certainly they've deployed, you know, how many, you know, a whole army from Siberia has come over. They've got this big force from the Eastern District that's been positioned in Belarus. This is unprecedented stuff for post-Soviet Russia. So, yeah, it's impossible to say. I myself kind of lean very mildly against an invasion, certainly an invasion and maybe even conflict. But anything could happen at this point. So, yeah, it'll be cool to watch and see what's happening and see what happens in the near future.
All right. Well, thanks so much for coming on, Prudentialist. It was good. Obviously, got plans, hopefully, to do more stuff with you in the future. Follow him on YouTube, Odyssey, everything else. Links in the description, as I said. And we'll see you guys all next time.